Chapter 1. The Morsolytica, Confraternity, Brothers. The dead of Dwell were screaming. The Morsolytic precinct was a place of terror for them now, where the cessation of mortal functions offered no respite from continual torment. 1,000 tech adepts died by the sword before enough had finally been compelled to repair the damage done in the wake of the Sons of Horus's assault, but repair it they had. The dead of the Morsolytic screamed from dawn till dusk, through the night and across every day, since Axemand had captured it in the name of the Warmaster. They screamed in fear, in horror, and revulsion. But most of all, they screamed in anger. Only the Warmaster heard them, and he cared nothing for their anger. His only interest was in what they could tell him of the past, as they had experienced it and as they had learned it. A vaulted sprawl of colonnaded stone structures that possessed the same scale as the palace of a mighty Terran patrician was here a repository of the dead and librarium in one. Plain facades of ochre granite shone like burnished copper in the dying sunlight, and the cries of circling seabirds almost made Horus Axemand forget a war had been fought here. Could almost make him forget that he nearly died here. The battle for the Morsolytic precinct had been won by bloody, shoulder-charging bodywork, blade to blade, muscle to muscle. There had been collateral damage, of course, machinery destroyed, stasis capsules smashed open, and preserved flesh turned to hard leather upon exposure to the unforgiving atmospherics. Blood still stained its walls in the catastrophic spray patterns of bodies detonated within ruptured personal shields. The ruined corpses of the compulsories were gone, but no one cared enough to wash away their blood. Axemand stood at a knee-high wall of sun-blushed stone, one foot on the parapet, forearms resting on his raised knee. The sound of waves far below was peaceful, and when the wind blew in from the ocean, the burned metal smell of the port was replaced with a tang of salt and wild flowers. From his vantage point upon the high plateau, the tumbled city of Tijon was much as it had been when the Sons of Horus made their first landings. His first impression was that a vast tidal surge had swept along the rift valley and deposited the forgotten detritus of an ocean upon its retreat. There appeared to be no order to the city, but Axemand had long since come to appreciate the organic subtleties of the city's ancient designers. "It is Protean," he would say when he found a willing ear. "A city that thrives on its disregard for clean lines and imposed clarity. The ostensive lack of cohesion is deceptive, for order exists within the chaos, which only becomes apparent when you walk its twisting paths and find that your destination has been set from the very beginning." Every building was unique in its own way, as though an army of architects had come to Tijon and each designed a wealth of structures from the salvaged steel and glass and stone. The only exception was the Dwellan Palace, a recent addition to the city that bore the utilitarian hallmarks of classical Macragian architecture. Taller than anything else in Tijon, it was a domed palace of imperial governance, a monument to the Great Crusade and an expression of Primarch Gilliman's vanity, all in one. It had mathematically precise proportions, and though Lupercal thought it austere, Axemand liked the restraint he saw in its elegantly crisp design. Exquisite statuary of imperial heroes stood proud around the circumference of the main azure dome and in recessed alcoves running the full height of the central arch. Axemand had learned the identity of every one before they were smashed. Chapter masters and captains of the Ultramarines and Iron Hands, army generals, Titan princeps, Munitorum pontiffs, and even a few exacter tithe takers. Evening sunlight honeyed the city's rooftops and the Sea of Enna was glassy and still. The water became a golden mirror, streaked with phosphor-bright reflections of orbiting warships, the occasional moon and void war debris falling far out to sea. The prow of a sunken cargo tanker jutted from the water at the quayside, petrochemical gels frothing its surface with oily scum. Far to the north, a glowing star clung stubbornly to the horizon, the twin of the sun setting in the south. This, Axemand knew, was no star, but the still-burning remains of the Budean ship school, its orbit degrading with each planetary revolution. Won't be long until that impacts, said a voice behind him. True, agreed Axemand without turning. It's not going to be pretty, said another. Best we're gone before then. We should have left here long ago, added a fourth. Axemand finally turned from a bucolic vision of Taijun and nodded to his battle brothers. Morneval, he said. The War Master calls for us. The Morneval restored. But then it had never been lost, just broken a while. Axemand marched with Ezekiel Abaddon. In his spiked warrior plate, the first captain of the Sons of Horus was more than a head taller than Axemand. His body language was savagely aggressive, cruelly planed features pulled hard over jutting bones. His skull was hairless, save for a glossy black topknot jutting from his crown like a tribal fetish. He and Abaddon were old hands, Morneval from the time before the galaxy had slipped a gear and turned to a very different hand at the crank. They had spilled blood on 100 worlds in the name of the Emperor, hundreds more for the War Master. And they had once laughed as they fought. The two newest members of the Morneval marched alongside their proposers, lunar marks graven upon their helms by the reflected light of Dwell's moon. One was a warrior with a reputation, the other a sergeant who'd earned his during the disaster of Dwell's fall. Widowmaker Kyber commanded the Justerian Terminators, one of Abaddon's men and a true son. Where Kyber was seasoned and war-known, Grail Noctua of the Warlocked was new to the men of the Legion. A warrior possessed of a mind like a steel trap, his intellect was likened by Abaddon to a slow blade. With Kyber's investiture, a potent weight of choler lay to one side of the Morneval. Axemand hoped Noctua's phlegmatic presence would counterbalance it. There had been rumblings of the favour Axemand showed Noctua, but Dwell silenced them all. With their two newest brothers, Axemand and Abaddon led the way to the central Morzolitic Hall in answer to the War Master's summons. "Do you think it will be a mobilization order?" asked Noctua. Like all of them, he was eager to be unleashed. The war here was long ended, and but for a handful of forays beyond the system, the bulk of the Legion had remained in place while their Primarch sequestered himself with the dead. "Perhaps," said Axemand, unwilling to speculate on the War Master's motives for remaining on Dwell. "We will know soon enough." "We should be on the move," said Kyber. "The war gathers momentum while we stagnate with inaction." Abaddon halted their march and placed a hand in the centre of the Widowmaker's breastplate. "You think you know the course of war better than your Primarch?" Kyber shook his head. "Of course not. I just..." "First lesson of the Morneval," said Axemand. "Never second-guess Lupercal." "I wasn't second-guessing him," snapped Kyber. "Good," said Axemand. "Then you've learned something useful today. Perhaps the War Master has found what he needed, perhaps not. Maybe we will have mobilization orders, maybe we won't." Kyber nodded, and Axemand saw him force his volatile humours into balance. "As you say, little Horus, the molten Chthonian core that burns in us all waxes stronger in me than most." Axemand chuckled, though the sound was not, as he once knew it, the muscles beneath the skin moving in subtly different ways. "You say that like it's a bad thing," he said. "Just remember that fire needs to be controlled to be useful." "Most of the time," added Abaddon, and they moved off again. They traversed high-vaulted antechambers of fallen pillars and halls of bolt-cratered frescoes that had once been battlefields. The air thrummed with the vibration of buried generators and tasted like an embalming workshop. Between murals of cobalt-blue Legion warriors being welcomed with garlands, tens of thousands of names were inlaid on coffered panels with gold leaf. The interred dead of the Morzolitica.
"Like the Avenue of Glory and Lament on the Spirit," said Axemand, pointing out the fine scriptwork.
Abaddon snorted, not even glancing at the names.
"It hasn't been called that since Istvan. The necrologists may be gone," sighed Axemand, "but it is as it has always been. A place to remember the dead."
They climbed a wide set of marbled steps, crunching over the powdered remains of toppled statues, and emerging into a transverse hallway Axemand had fought the length and breadth of, shield raised, Mourn It All's blade high, shoulders squared, soaked in blood to the elbow.
"Dreaming again?" asked Abaddon, noting his fractional pause. "I don't dream," snapped Axamond. "I'm just thinking how ridiculous it was that an army of men were able to trouble us here. When have we ever faced mortals and found them bothersome?"
Abaddon nodded. "The Chainvale fought in the City of Elders. They delayed me." No more needed to be said. That any army, mortal or transhuman, could delay Ezekiel Abaddon spoke volumes to their competency and courage.
"But they all died in the end," said Kyber as they passed beneath a great funerary arch and moved deeper into the tomb complex. "Chainvale or ordinary soldiers, they stood against us in the line and we killed them all."
"That they stood at all should have told us there was something else waiting for us," said Grail Noctua.
"How so?" said Axamand, knowing the answer, but wanting to hear it articulated.
"The men who fought us here, they believed they could win."
"Their defence was orchestrated by Medusan of the Iron Tenth," said Axamand. "It's understandable they believed him."
"Only Legion presence gives mortals that kind of backbone," continued Noctua. "With the 10th Legion's war leader and the kill teams of the 5th Legion in place, they thought they had a chance. They thought they could kill the War Master."
Kyber shook his head. "Even if Lupercal had fallen for their transparent ploy and come himself, he would easily have slain them." More than likely, Kyber was right. It was inconceivable that a mere 5 legionaries could have ended the War Master. Even with surprise in their corner, the idea that Horus could be brought low by a rush team of blade killers seemed ludicrous.
"He outwitted a sniper's bullet on Dagonet, and he evaded the assassin's swords on Dwell," said Abaddon, kicking over an engraved urn emblazoned with a splintered ultima. "Medusan must have been desperate to think the scars stood a chance."
"Desperate is exactly what he was," said Axamand, feeling the itch where his face had been reattached. "Just imagine if they'd succeeded."
No one answered. No one could conceive of the Legion without Lupercal at its head. Without one, the other did not exist. But Shadrach Medusan had failed to lure the War Master into his trap, and Dwell had fallen hard. Against Horus Lupercal's armies, everything fell, eventually.
"Why defend the dead at all?" said Kyber. "Aside from commanding the high ground over an open city, holding the Morsolytica offers no tangible strategic merit. We could have simply shelled it flat and sent Lithonan's army auxiliaries in to kill any survivors."
"They knew the War Master would want so precious a resource captured intact," said Noctua.
"It's a house of the dead," pressed Kyber. "What kind of resource is that?"
"Now you're Mournival, why don't you ask him yourself?" answered Noctua.
Kyber's head snapped around, unused to being addressed with such informality by a junior officer. Mournival equality was going to take time to bed in with a Widowmaker.
"Tread lightly, Noctua," warned Abaddon. "You might be one of us now, but don't think that exempts you from respect."
Axamond grinned at Abaddon's ire. Ezekiel was a warhound on a fraying leash, and Axamond wondered if he knew that was his role. Of course, Ezekiel knew. A warrior did not become first captain of the Sons of Horus by being too stupid to know his place.
"Apologies," said Noctua, turning to address Kyber directly. "No disrespect was intended."
"Good," said Axamand. "Now give Falcus a proper answer."
"The Morsolytica occupies the best defensive terrain in the Rift Valley, but it's barely fortified," said Noctua, "which suggests the dwellers valued it highly but didn't think of it as a military target until Medusan told them it was."
Axamand nodded and slapped a gauntleted hand on the polished plates of Noctua's shoulder guard.
"So why did the Iron Hands think this place was valuable?" asked Kyber.
"I have no idea," said Axamand. Only later would he come to understand that the dwellers would have been far better demolishing the Morsolytic halls and smashing its machinery to shards than allowing it to fall to the Sons of Horus. Only much later, when the last violent spasms of galactic war were stilled for a heartbeat, would Axamand learn the colossal mistake they had made in allowing the Morsolytic to endure.
They found the Primarch in Pilgrim's Hall, where ancient machinery allowed the Morsolytic's custodians to access and consult the memories of the dead. The custodians had joined their charges in death, and Horus Lupercal commanded the machines alone.
A colossal cryogenerator throbbed with power in the centre of the echoing chamber, like a templum organ with a multitude of frost-limbed ducts emerging from its misting condensers. Smeared charnel dust patterned its base, where the White Scars kill team had thrown off their disguises. Radiating outward from the generator like the spokes of an illuminated wheel were row upon row of supine bodies in stacked glass cylinders. Axemand had logged 25,000 bodies in this hall alone, and there were 50 similar-sized spaces above ground. He hadn't yet catalogued how many chambers were carved into the plateau's bedrock. The War Master was easy to see. His back was to them as he bent over a cylindrical tube hinged out from its gravimetric support field. 20 Justerian Terminators stood between them and the War Master, armed with photonic-edged falchions and twin-barreled bolters. Nominally the War Master's bodyguard, the Justerian were a throwback to a time when war leaders actually required protection. Horus no more needed their strength of arms to defend him than he needed that of the Mournival, but after Hibu Khan's ambush, no one was taking any chances. As ever, the Primarch was a lodestone to the eyes, a towering presence to which it was right and proper to offer devotion. An easy smile suggested Horus had only just noticed them, but Axeman didn't doubt he had been aware of them long before they entered the hall. Titanic plates of brass-edged jet encased him, the plastron emblazoned with a slitted amber eye flanked by golden wolves. Horus's right hand was a killing talon, and his left rested upon an enormous mace. Its name was Worldbreaker, and its adamantium haft was featureless save for an eagle pummel stone, its murder head bronze and black. The War Master had the face of a conqueror, a warrior, a diplomat, and a statesman. It could be a kindly face of paternal concern, or the last face you ever saw. Axemand could not yet tell which it was at this moment, but on a day like this such ambiguity was good. To have Lupercal's humours unknown to those who stood with him would vex those who might yet stand against him. "Little Horus," said the War Master, as the Justerian parted before them like the gates of a Ceramite fortress. The uncanny resemblance between Axemand, shared with his gene father, had earned him that name, but Hibu Khan had cut that from him with a blade of hard Medusan steel. Legion apothecaries had done what they could, but the damage was too severe, the edge too sharp, and his wounded flesh too melancholic. Yet for all that his face was raw with disfigurement, the resemblance between Axemand and his Primarch had, by some strange physiological alchemy, become even more pronounced. "War Master," said Axemand, "your Mournival." Horus nodded and studied each of them in turn, as though assessing the alloyed composition of the restored confraternity. "I approve," he said. "The blend looks to be a good one."
"Time will tell," said Axemand.
"As it does in all things," answered Horus, coming forward to stand before the sergeant of the Warlocked. "Axeman's protege, a true son indeed," said Horus with a hint of pride. "I hear good things about you, Grail. Are they true?" To his credit, Noctua retained his senses in the face of the War Master's appraisal, but he could not meet his gaze for long.
"Yes, my lord," he managed. "Maybe. I do not know what you have heard."
"Good things," said Horus, nodding and moving on to take the Widowmaker's gauntlet in his taloned grip. "You're tense, Falcus," he said. "Inaction doesn't suit you."
"What can I say? I was built for war," said Kyber,
with more tact than Axemand expected. "More than most," agreed Horus. "Don't worry, I'll not have you and the Justerian idle for much longer." The War Master came to Abaddon and said, "And you, Ezekiel, you hide it better than the Widowmaker, but I see you also chafe at our enforced stay on Dwell."
"There is a war to be won, my lord," said Abaddon, his tone barely on the right side of rebuke, "and I won't have it said that the sons of Horus let other legions do their fighting for them."
"Nor would I, my son," said Horus, placing his talon upon Abaddon's shoulders. "We have been distracted by the schemes and petty vengeance of others, but that time is over." Horus turned and accepted a blood-red war cloak from one of the Justerian. He snapped it around his shoulders, fixing it in place with a pair of wolf-claw pins at each pauldron. "Axemand,
Are they here? Asked Horus. They are, said Axemand, but you already know that.
True, agreed Horus. Even when we were without form, I always knew if they were close.
Axemand saw a rogue glint in Horus's eye and decided he was joking. Rare were the moments when Horus spoke of his years with the Emperor. Rarer still were insights to the time before that.
In my more arrogant moments, I used to think that was why the Emperor came to me first, continued Horus, and Axemand saw he'd been mistaken. Horus was, most assuredly, not joking. I thought he needed my help to find the rest of his lost sons. Then sometimes I think it was a cruel punishment to feel so deep a connection to my gene kin, only to be set apart from them.
Horus fell silent, and Axemand said,
They wait for you in the Dome of Revivification.
Good. I'm eager to join them. Abaddon's fists clenched.
Then we are to rejoin the war? Ezekiel, my son, we never left it, said Horus.
The Dome of Revivification was a vast hemisphere of glass and transparisteel atop the largest of the morsolitic stone structures. It was a place of reverence and solemn purpose, a place where the preserved memories of the dead could be returned to life. Access was gained via a latticework elevator that rose into the center of the dome. Horus and the Mournival stood at the center of the platform as it made its stately ascent. Over Kyber's protests, the Justerian had been left below, leaving the five of them alone. Axemand looked up to the wide opening in the floor high above them. He saw the cracked structure of the crystalline dome beyond, sunset darkening to nightfall. Slanted columns of moonlight slid over the elevator as it emerged into the dome. A rogue shell had damaged its hemispherical structure, and shards of hardened glass lay strewn across the polished metal floor like diamond-bladed knives. Spaced at equidistant intervals around the outer circumference of the elevator were berths for dozens of cryocylinders. None were currently occupied. Axemand took a shocked breath of frosted air as he saw the demigods awaiting within. He had known, of course, who the War Master had summoned, but to see two such numinous beings before him was still a moment of revelation. One was a being of immaterial flesh, the other stolidly physical. Horus spread his arms in greeting.
My brothers, said Horus, his voice filling the dome, welcome to Dwell.
Rumours had reached the sons of Horus of the changes wrought in some of the War Master's brothers, but nothing could have prepared Axemand for just how profound those changes were. The last time he had seen the Primarch of the Emperor's children, Fulgrim had been the perfect warrior, a snow-maned hero in purple and gold plate. Now the Phoenician was the physical embodiment of an ancient, many-armed destroyer god, serpentine of body and clad in exquisite fragments of his once magnificent armour, Fulgrim was a beautiful monster, a being to be mourned for the splendour he had lost and admired for the power he had gained. Mortarion of the Death Guard stood apart from Fulgrim's sinuous form and at first glance appeared unchanged. A closer look into his sunken eyes revealed the pain of recent hurts, worn like a ragged mourning shroud. Silence, the Death Lord's towering battle reaper, was serrated with battle notches, and a long, looping chain affixed to its pommel was wrapped around his wrist like a belt. Jangling censers hung from the chains, each one venting tiny puffs of hot vapour. His baroquely fashioned barbaran plate bore numerous marks of the artificer, ceramite infill, fresh paint, and lapping powder. From the amount of repair work, whatever battle he had recently fought must have been ferocious. As Horus had dismissed the Justerian, so too had his brother Primarchs come unescorted. Fulgrim absent the Phoenix Guard, Mortarion without his death shroud, though Axemand didn't doubt both were close. Being in the presence of the War Master was an honour, but to be present at a moment where three Primarchs came together was intoxicating. Fulgrim and Mortarion had travelled to Dwell to see Horus Lupercal, but the War Master had not come to be seen. He had come to be heard. Fulgrim's body coiled beneath him with a hiss of rasping scales, raising him up higher than Mortarion and the War Master.
Horus,
said Fulgrim, each syllable veiled with subtle meaning.
We live in the greatest tumult the galaxy has known, and you haven't changed at all. How disappointing.
Whereas you have changed beyond all recognition, said Horus. A pair of slick draconic wings unfolded from Fulgrim's back, and dark pigmentation rippled through his body.
More than you know,
whispered Fulgrim.
Less than you think, answered Horus. But tell me, does Perturabo yet live? I'm going to need his legion when the walls of Terra are brought down.
I left him alive, said Fulgrim, though what has become of him since my elevation is a mystery to me. The, what did he name it? Ah, yes, the Eye of Terror is no place for one so firmly rooted in material concerns.
What did you do to the Lord of Iron?
Demanded Mortarion, his voice rasping from behind the bronze breather apparatus covering the lower half of his face.
I freed him from foolish notions of permanence, said Fulgrim. I honored him by allowing his strength to fuel my ascension to this higher state of being. That in the end he would not sacrifice all for his beloved brother.
Fulgrim sniggered.
I think I broke him a little bit.
You used him, said Mortarion, to become this.
We are all using one another. Didn't you know that?
Laughed Fulgrim, sliding over the floor of the chamber and admiring himself in broken glass reflections.
To achieve greatness, we must accept the blessing of new things and new forms of power. I have taken that teaching to heart and embrace such change willingly. You would do well to follow my example, Horus.
The spear aimed at the Emperor's heart must not be pliant but unyielding iron, said Horus. I am that unyielding iron.
Horus turned to Mortarion, who didn't even bother to hide his revulsion at what had become of the Phoenician.
As are you, my brother, said Horus, coming forward to grip the Death Lord's wrist, warrior to warrior. You are a wonder to me, my indomitable friend. If not even the Khan's strength could lay you low, what hope have any others?
His fleetness of war is a thing of wonder,
admitted Mortarion.
But rob him of it, and he is nothing. I will reap him yet.
And I would see it so, promised Horus, releasing his grip. On the soil of Terra we shall hobble the Khan and see how well he fights.
I am your servant, said Mortarion.
Horus shook his head. No, never that. Never a servant. We fight this war, so we need be no man's slave. I would not have you exchange one master for another. I need you at my side as an equal, not a vassal.
Mortarion nodded, and Axemand saw the Death Guard Primarch stand taller at Lupercal's words.
And your sons, said Horus. Does Typhon still bait the lion's hunters?
Since Perditus, he has been leading the monks of Caliban a merry dance through the stars, leaving death and misery in his wake,
replied Mortarion, with a grunt of amusement that puffed toxic emanations from his gorget.
By your leave, I will soon join him and turn the hunters into the hunted.
Soon enough, Mortarion, soon enough, said Horus. With your legion mustered for war, I almost feel sorry for the lion.
Fulgrim bristled that he had received no words of praise, but Horus wasn't done.
Now more than ever I need you both at my side, not as allies and not as subordinates, but as equals. I hold to the name Warmaster not because of what it represented when it was bestowed, but because of what it means now.
And what is that?
Asked Fulgrim. Horus looked into the Venetian's aquiline features, alabaster in their cold perfection. Axemand felt the power of connection that flowed between them, a struggle for dominance that could have only one victor. Fulgrim looked away, and Horus said, "It means that only I have the strength to do what must be done. Only I can bring my brothers together under one banner and remake the Imperium."
"You always were prideful," said Fulgrim,
and Axemand felt the urge to grip Mornitor's hilt at the Phoenician's tone, but the sword was no longer belted at his side, its blade badly notched and still in need of repair. Horus ignored the barb and said, "If I am prideful, it is pride in my brothers, pride in what you have accomplished since last we stood together. It is why I have summoned you, and no others, to my side now." Fulgrim grinned and said,
"Then what would you have of me, War Master?"
"The thing I spoke to in the wake of Istvan, is it gone from you now? You are Fulgrim once again?"
"I have scoured my flesh of the creature's presence."
"Good," said Horus. "What I say here is legion business, and does not concern the things that dwell beyond our world."
"I cast the warp thing out, but I learned a great many things from it while our souls were entwined."
"What things?" asked Mortarion.
"We have bargained with their masters, made pacts,"
hissed Fulgrim, pointing a sickle blade talon at Horus.
"You have made blood pacts with gods, and oaths to gods should not lightly be broken."
"It sickens me to my bones to hear you speak of keeping faith with oaths," said Mortarion.
The War Master raised a hand to ward off Fulgrim's venomous response and said, "You are both here because I have need of your unique talents. The wrath of the Sons of Horus is to be unleashed once more, and I would not see it without my brothers at my side." Horus walked a slow circle, weaving his words around Mortarion and Fulgrim like a web. Erebus raised his great ruin storm on Kalth and split the galaxy asunder. Beyond its tempests, the 500 worlds burned in Lorgar and Angron's shadow crusade, but their wanton slaughters are of no consequence for now. What happens here, with us, with you, is what will make the difference between victory or defeat. The War Master's words were lure and balm all in one, obvious even to Axemand, but they were having the desired effect.
"Are we to march on Terra at last?"
asked Mortarion. Horus laughed. "Not yet, but soon. It is in preparation for that day that I have called you here." Horus stepped back and lifted his arms as ancient machinery rose from the floor like rapid outgrowths of coral, unfolding and expanding with mechanized precision. 100 or more glass cylinders rose with them, each containing a body lying forever on the threshold of existence and oblivion. From previously unseen entrances, a host of weeping tech adepts and black-robed mechanicum entered, taking up positions alongside the gently glowing cylinders. "By any mortal reckoning, our father is a god," said Horus. "And for all that he has allowed his dominion to fall to rebellion, he is still too powerful to face."
"Even for you?"
said Fulgrim with a grin. "Even for me," agreed Horus. "To slay a god, a warrior must first become a god himself." Horus paused. "At least, that's what the dead tell me."